This is 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have you with us on a red hot day here in the nitty gritty city as you listen to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. We're gonna play around on the dark side here today. out in Lee Summit, the Summit Theater of Lee Summit is presenting the musical Assassins, where they feature some of the most notorious assassins in the history of our country. And with us are two of the assassins, and the director of the show, Nino Cassisi, is with us as well. Show opens Thursday, the 25th, just a few days from now, at the Cultural Arts Center on the campus of Longview Community College. Do they call it the community college anymore? They probably don't. The Metropolitan College?
Yeah, it's MCC now. Yeah. So it's part of...
Later on, we'll get directions, but it's in the south part of town with a partnership that Summit Theater has with the community college down there, of course. But we're here to talk about Assassins. Nino Cassisi, the director, is with us. I don't know. Was it a dark side of your nature that caused you to want to do this particular musical? It is a musical, by the way.
It is.
A dark side musical.
It is a musical. I thought, well, wouldn't it be great to do a show like this right around the 4th of July? Well, it was either that or President's Day, so we chose the 4th of July because it's nice and hot. So, and it's a hot show, so... Come see it. It's going to be a blast.
And it is a musical.
It is.
Don't know that. The assassins all sing.
Yes, they do. Each one has a signature song that pretty much tells who they are and why they did what they did.
Yeah. It ought to be interesting to delve into the mind of of the assassins.
Yes. And Sondheim made it a point to say we do not glorify the assassins. We just give them their platform to tell their story.
How many assassins are featured in the show? Two of them are here today.
Two of them are here today. We have nine.
Nine
overall.
It's a lot of assassins.
Yes. Yes, and each one of them gets their own little limelight, if you will.
With us is Cody Geffner. He plays the role of John Wilkes Booth. So, actor, Booth, it kind of figures.
Yeah,
don't you
think? Absolutely, yeah. He's been a very fun and exciting role to try to figure out the character.
It's fun.
In its own little way, yeah, absolutely.
Well, what did you learn about perhaps his motivation through the songs that you sing?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, John Booth, Wilkes Booth, if you will, is he's probably one of the more well-known assassins of the ones that we get a kind of peer into their history here during Assassins musical. But you just kind of started picking out some of the things I didn't know about it. And that was the song that I am showcased in is going to be The Ballad of Booth. And it's his moment at the end of his life in the barn, whenever he has been surrounded by the Union soldiers. And he just kind of sings this beautiful, heart-wrenching ballad, if you will, just kind of telling his side of the story, saying, don't let history rob me of everything I did. I did this act for a reason. I gave my life up for it. And I want that to go forward, not Abraham Lincoln's side of it. Mm. And that's kind of how the whole show starts, is him setting it aside, saying, we're going to tell our side of the story. Don't listen to everything you've heard in history. Listen to us for the next hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes.
We all hear that Booth was politically motivated. Anything in your studying of the character cause you to change that at all?
You know, the character development I did, the histories, books that I read, the articles all pointed towards the conspiracy that they had tried to take down the entire Union government, but he was the only successful one of his conspiracy that was able to do so. So to be able to bring that history, we don't get to see the build up to it when it comes to Booth. We have the moment, we hear the shot, but it goes from the shot and it fast forwards 14 days to his last moment. So it's kind of filling in the gaps of everything that everybody knows in the historical part of the assassination. We kind of just assume that the audience knows it, and we bring them to that last moment where there's a little bit more mystery surrounding what happened in the barn. And Sondheim's just done a beautiful job of dictating that and lyrically just showing the audience everything that you can imagine and probably then some.
Well, sure. Well, more of Booth coming up. We move on now to Dane Shnocke is with us. He plays the role of Leon... Czolgosz. I almost got them all. He's not one of the most known assassins.
Oh, no.
He assassinated William McKinley.
Yeah.
Although McKinley didn't die right away.
That's correct. Yes, he died a few days after that from infection.
So since most of us don't know Czolgosz, what were his motivations for wanting to kill President McKinley?
Well,
who we don't think of McKinley as being controversial.
right. He was very well liked at the time of his presidency. Leon Czolgosz was the son of Polish immigrants, and he was very, very poor from a young age. He worked in a steel factory for most of his life, and after getting let go from his job at the factory, he sort of devolved into abject poverty, and he became involved in the anarchist movement, which was at the time led by Emma Goldman, who was a very prominent figure during that period. And because he was so captivated by Goldman, he was inspired by her writings and her speeches to take down sort of the heads of state in the United States. He believed specifically that the office of the presidency had gotten too powerful and that it was his job as an anarchist to take down the government of Peg. So
yeah, well, he realized that the vice president would take over, and then after that, the speaker of the House, president pro tempore. There would be no end to taking down the government.
Right. Obviously.
Yes. Yeah. He was an interesting guy. You know, from everything that I've read, he was always sort of very quiet, and he very much kept to himself. He was apparently a very good worker from all the reports that we have from the factories that he worked at. He was apparently very skilled at what he did, but he was let go because he went on strike. And at that time, when unions went on strike, when people went on strike, they were largely just fired and blacklisted. So he couldn't find employment anywhere else.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, more on him coming up. I always have trouble with a strange pronunciation. Nino, there is nine altogether. Who else, what other assassins, I should say, are presented in the show?
Well, we have pretty much the ones that everyone knows through history. We've got Lee Harvey Oswald, John Wilkes Booth, Lynette Squeaky Frome.
She was unsuccessful.
She was very unsuccessful. Her and Sarah Jane Moore both had had Ford on the mind. Gerald Ford. So
they did within a week or two of each other.
Yeah, it was like 20 days.
Yeah,
it just didn't work. 17 days or something. Yeah, it didn't work out. Charlie Gâteau. who also did try to kill or did kill President James Garfield. Another one people didn't really know about, really. Giuseppe Zangara, who tried to kill FDR back in the day. And John Hinckley.
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan. And, of course, Leon Czolgosz.
Yeah.
Czolgosz.
Not all of them. We're breaking the trend. Not all of them have middle names.
No.
Did Leon have a middle name?
No. He had a middle name, but he just didn't go by it.
It was like William or something.
It was difficult for the papers.
It was Frank.
It was Frank.
Yeah, Frank. It was the most normal of his names.
Yeah. Well, how do you portray your assassins in a sympathetic way? I mean, that's kind of hard to do, but it's doable.
It is. We don't. Really, throughout the song itself, each of the songs that Sondheim and John Weidman wrote, actually more Sondheim, the songs themselves tell the story in such a way that you have no choice but to feel sorry for some of these people. Like when Hinckley sings Unworthy of Your Love with Squeaky Frome, even though they're not singing to each other, they're singing about the loves of their lives, which just happened to be Jodie Foster and Charlie Manson.
That's right.
another dark road that we go down. You really do feel that they love these entities, but yet you can't fathom why. I mean, you don't get deep into their head to even understand, but yet you feel sympathetic when they sing the song. Yeah. If that makes any sense in the world.
Yeah. Is there a lot of... It's mostly music, I guess.
Yes. There are some scattered scenes throughout. Like Sarah Jane Moore and Squeaky Fromm have many scenes in the park because they always meet in a park for some reason.
Did they know each other in reality at all?
I don't believe they did, no. They just had the same goal in life.
The same strange idea.
Just to take out Gerald Ford for whatever reason.
The show actually exists in sort of a limbo, and that's why a lot of these historical characters, who obviously none of which actually met each other, interact and stuff. So, I mean, there's a scene where Chulgosh is interacting with John Wilkes Booth and John Hinckley Jr., who obviously they lived, you know, decades apart.
Yeah. In fact, Hinckley is even free now.
Yeah, just recently.
And Fromm, yeah. I believe.
Yeah. She is. Yeah, she was on one of the tabloid. She was on one of the tabloid
the
shows.
Show.
She was on one of the tabloid shows not too long ago. She has gray hair now rather than red.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's out there living her life, trying to explain Charlie to everybody.
Yeah,
which is difficult.
Yeah.
So she could come to the show.
Yeah,
imagine that.
The show itself actually takes place at a carnival, which I think is brilliant to bring all of the assassins together to play a carnival game. Called Shoot the Prez, Win a Prize.
Oh.
And that's basically where we start telling the tales of all these.
Is there a common thread other than the fact that they're probably not all 100% in their thinking? But is there any other common thread? Did they all feel oppressed? Did they all have access to grind? Did they have unhappy lives?
Yes, yes, and yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were all very unhappy, very unsuccessful in their own lives, and felt that there was something else better for them to do. And so they figured taking down someone of a higher capacity, may it be, you know, in this case the president, that would somehow help them to go farther in life, especially with Squeaky Fromm. She wanted to do it to show her love for Charlie Manson.
Yeah.
To show Charlie, hey, this guy is great, and I'll prove it. And she basically does what she does to earn his love. And
his attraction is puzzling, to say the least.
Yes, to say the least.
Did any of the others do it for anyone rather than for... It sounds like Leon did it for himself and his cause. Booth certainly... Well, maybe for himself to a degree, but certainly for his cause.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Hinckley would be the only one I could think of that he did it professing his love for Jodie Foster. Which, it's just, yeah, it's that mindset of, it's kind of like they have these great ideas and then they get right up to it and then swerve off in the wrong direction. And it's like, Booth had a great idea of, you know, wanting his side to come on top of it. He didn't believe the same things as Lincoln, but the way that he went about doing it was completely the wrong way of assassinating him or having this entire conspiracy together. And it's just, they had some, I mean, from Booth's perspective, he had a great cause that he believed in, just went about finishing it in a completely wrong and devastating way.
Oh, sure. Now that was a conspiracy, a true conspiracy.
Yeah, yeah.
Because not only was the president the target, also the vice president, the secretary of state.
Yeah.
Secretary of Defense, they didn't call it that then.
Yeah, it wasn't state then. But yeah, there were a list of them. And all of his conspirators, I believe, were hung after he was killed.
Even though they all failed, except for Booth, I believe.
Yeah, he was the only
Now, the vice president, I guess, was injured. But his son, as I recall from my reading, his son fought off the attacker who had a knife.
Yeah, and he was very badly injured, but survived somehow.
Which son was that?
Yeah.
Todd?
No, it wasn't Lincoln's son. It was the vice president.
Yeah, it was.
I think it was Secretary of State Henry Seward.
Yeah, Seward was. Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Seward was ill in bed, and that's where he was attacked. But his son was there and fought off the assailant. We're speaking with two of the assassins and the director of the new show. It's easy to fall into this trap here of talking about history. But it's the Summit Theater presentation of Assassins. It opens this Thursday, the 25th at 7:30 p.m. Performances continue on the 26th at 7:30, Saturday the 27th at 7:30, and it wraps up with a Sunday the 20th. 28th matinee at 2:30 at the Cultural Arts Center on the campus of the Longview Community College. The number to call for more information is 816-463-2654, or you can go online at, I guess it's now summittheater.org.
Yes.
The website has changed for, I know several times I've had Summit on and the website has changed. So yes, that's the correct one now.
That is correct.
SummitTheater.org. Speaking with the director and two of the assassins. Nino is the director. Mostly musicals for Nino. Do you prefer
lately,
musicals
yeah.
rather than other shows?
Well, it kind of depends. I've got a bucket list
really?
Of shows.
Oh, well, you talked about this before.
This has been on the bucket list for like 10 years now.
Well, what's so fascinating about showing these assassins?
The music and the stories, just the show itself is just so beautifully written. It's just one of those shows that you have to tackle at least once in your life.
Uh-huh.
And it tells such a captivating story.
So you have nine assassins and they all have numbers to sing.
Yes, they do. Yes. I was like, numbers, like five?
I'm number one.
We
have number three.
Oh, I'm sure they all think they're number one. One song, I guess they have... we sort of answered this before. You have a couple of main numbers, then you sing with others at the mm-hmm. same time.
Yeah, the way that they wrote this show, I mean, if you listen to any interview by Sondheim, he will say that this is his closest to perfection musical that he's ever written. And it's just so true. As we've been diving into it, a lot of the cast members and the crew, we've had these questions of, why would they place this scene here, or this song? Why wouldn't they do it here? Why are they... beginning with the end of Booth, or, you know, here and there, why do we only sympathize with the Americans at the end of the show? And we don't even think about the citizens and how they were feeling until the end of it. You know, we've been asking these questions, and as we've been going through, we're going, oh, okay, that's why. You know, Sondheim, it's this musical genius that a lot of times our music director will even go, if you just follow what he's already written for you, lyrically and musically, he's done half your work, if not a majority of it
sure.
for you. And just to be able to weave these stories together, to put all the assassins in one place at one time and have their unique personalities clash when they need to and not clash when they don't need to and just play their own roles. It's very unique, like nothing else. No other musical theater, you know, production you're ever going to find. They say the difference is the way that the assassins see history is the Constitution says you have the right to pursue happiness.
Well, sure.
And yeah. they've notated, lyricized it as everybody has the right to be happy. Not to pursue the happiness, but to actually be happy. And that's where it kind of gets mixed up a little bit. And that's how the assassins, what kind of shoots them into their destinies of becoming.
And the pursuit of happiness has played a part in several Supreme Court decisions.
Oh, completely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just wide enough that things can get through there.
Yeah. And it's just amazing taking out that one word, the pursuit yeah. of happiness, oh, yeah. just blows open this entire
idea. You're not guaranteed happiness, but you're allowed to pursue it.
Yeah.
It would be impossible, of course, to guarantee happiness, as everyone really knows right. if they think
not
about
to
it.
These guys. Trust me, throughout the entire show, they're going, this will do it.
Well, Booth is one of the most fascinating ones, I think, because he was an actor.
Yeah.
And his brother was a famous actor as
and
well as his father
yeah.
and they were both more famous than he was.
He was, yeah.
On a certain level, was this his way of reaching up to their level?
You know,
perhaps?
It's actually mentioned in the show in history. You know, did you do this because you're in the shadow of your brother? And there are 1,000 reasons behind why Booth could have done this. I mean, you just throw a stone and you're going to hit another reason that could have been something that drove him over the edge. The neatest thing, I think, is the revelation of his diary and being able to kind of dive into that, because he notated in those last 14 days of his life, he kept a word for word diary of his journey, why he did it. He wanted his side of the story told. And Sondheim has done another brilliant job of bringing that natural verbiage from Booth's original mouth as he's writing in the diary and putting that into lyrics that are opening up to the audience and just kind of verbally telling them his side of the story, saying, you've always heard it this way. I took down Abraham Lincoln. How dare I? But wait a second. You know, I had all these things against me and I did what was best for the country.
Well,
it's just
to his viewpoint.
To his viewpoint, completely.
Oh, sure. Now, in the case of Czolgosz, Leon Czolgosz, good old Leon.
Yeah, good old Leon.
Good old Leon Frank.
His seemed truly political.
Yes.
And he perhaps felt oppressed, and his family felt oppressed.
Very much
his
so.
Is perhaps understandable, although not understandable
of
in
course.
The true sense of the word.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, Czolgosz, he really was a fascinating person because he did all of these things. I say all these things. Really, his entire life was summarized in a single act, sort of like Booth. And Booth alludes to the fact that the assassins very much are summarized by the single thing that they have done. And, you know, in Booth's case at least, much of his acting career will be forgotten because he has done this other thing. But in the case of Czolgosz, he very much was below the radar. And the only reason anybody knows who he is because he shot this very important person. Uh-huh. It's just very
what was the big? Do you know what was the big controversial issues on the table for the country at that time? Anything that he particularly identified with?
Specifically, the workers and the rich bosses' oppression of the workers. You know, with the rising anarchist movement, there was a feeling that the people who were in power needed to be taken down because they weren't treating everybody below them fairly.
Sure.
And so Czolgosz very much bought into this. And interestingly enough, I mentioned earlier that he was sort of captivated by Emma Goldman, the anarchist writer and speaker. After Czolgosz assassinated President McKinley, Goldman actually released a statement praising his action, which was sort of odd, right? Because, you know, she was this person who people knew, you know, and the authorities tried to connect her with some sort of plot to assassinate the president, but ultimately there was no real evidence. So really the only thing that supported that was simply just that she had supported him assassinating the president, not that she had actually helped.
They gave her a stand for rhetoric, if
right,
else.
Right, yeah. Sure, yeah. Sure.
Made her more in demand on the speakers.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fascinating. And once again, if you've just tuned in, there are nine assassins in the show. Booth and Czolgosz were just two of them. And the others are, we talked about
Hinckley,
Squeaky
Zangara,
Frome,
Squeaky.
And Hinckley, who, I know Squeaky is free because I've seen her on some of the entertainment shows.
I think Sarah Jane Moore is still living. I think she's also free at this point.
And Hinckley may soon be free to wander around on a limited basis. He was actually found guilty by reason of insanity. So there was always a chance that he would be free again. He could show up here.
Yeah.
Well, I believe
he could come to your show.
I think that a little under. Yeah, that'd be great.
A little he would get the senior citizen discount now.
Right. We have a special guest tonight.
So would you.
There's always that chance in a situation like this. We never know.
I believe recently, because in the Hinckley attempted assassination, he shot, who was it?
Ronald Reagan.
No. I know that she shot Ronald Reagan, but one of the shots that he fired actually struck one of Reagan's
Brady?
Top.
Oh,
yeah,
James Brady.
Yeah, James Brady.
The Brady Law.
Yeah, and Brady, I think, passed away a little under a year ago.
He lived a long time with his injuries.
He did.
But I guess he did technically die as a result of being shot.
Yeah, they charged him with homicide. Yeah. They charged.
He could be. Hinckley could be charged. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe he won't come see the show then.
But it's always
jail.
So,
poor guy.
All well-known assassins. They all don't have a middle name, as are the rumor that they all have a middle name. But it covers the gamut through history. Did Sondheim have a strike? He didn't name all of them, interestingly enough. Sirhan, for instance.
Yes.
Was
Sirhan gets mentioned. James Earl Ray gets mentioned.
There's one more that gets mentioned.
Can't think of his name.
The Bremer. Artie Bremer.
Bremer, yes. Some of the most notorious assassins in history are talked about and covered, and in the case of nine of them, sing for you.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, we didn't talk about Naturally. Bic. We didn't talk about Bic. Samuel Bick at all. Yeah.
I forgot about Bic.
The craziest of them
Bic.
Yes.
Arguably.
Samuel Bick was this guy from, I want to say, New York or Jersey or somewhere in the Northeast. And
Massachusetts,
he,
actually.
Oh, yeah, Massachusetts. I was wrong.
That's not true, actually. Did he tell you that? So he says, monologue. It's in this monologue. He starts it. He's driving. He's like cuts off his another car, throws something at him, says, "Sorry, I'm from Massachusetts." Well, the other day, Chad said he's not actually from Massachusetts. He's just being rude.
Interesting.
Oh. So I don't know if that holds anything.
Anyway, so
an assassin being rude. How?
Samuel Bick attempted to assassinate President Nixon by flying a plane into the White House.
Yeah.
Fortunately, he was. He was killed before he could hijack the plane.
He was actually killed in the cockpit, if I remember right. He actually killed himself. He turned the gun on himself.
At the very least.
So.
Interesting. Yeah, but the stories of these gentlemen, and
they're all shared.
And two ladies.
Yes.
are covered quite thoroughly in this Stephen Sondheim musical. Called Assassins. Opens this Thursday at the Lee Summit Cultural Arts Center, the Longview College campus. Performances continue then Friday evening, 7:30, Saturday at 7:30, and a matinee on Sunday afternoon, the 28th, on the campus of Longview College in the Cultural Arts Center. The number to call for more information, 816-463-2654. Or online at summittheater.org. And I made a little note here, available at the Hy-Vee store in Lee Summit
as well. Yes, I believe both Hy-Vee stores in Lee Summit have tickets available.
They have tickets as well. Well,
they're going fast, so yeah. I don't know where we're at.
Ought to be a fun show, especially for the artist involved. I want to thank my guest, Nino Cassisi, the director, a show that was on his bucket list for a long time.
Yes.
We'll let that sink in right there. Cody Gepner, who plays the role of John Wilkes Booth, an actor playing an actor.
Yes, thank you.
And Dana Schnacki, who plays the role of Leon Czolgosz. He assassinated President William McKinley.
That is correct.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You're a history buff. You'll learn some things, probably. Yeah. Thanks so much for being with us. When we return after our break, we're going to talk to this gentleman is a storyteller, a singer, a talent agent, and has a new book. When we return, you're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI. 90.1 FM.
Freeze Frame! Hi, I'm Russ Simmons with Freeze Frame, KKFI's weekly look at the newest cinematic fare at your local theaters. Well, they've done it again. Inside Out is not only another animated triumph for the folks at Pixar, it's easily one of the best movies of the year. Ever wonder what goes on in a young girl's head? Well, the magicians at Pixar have created an involving, funny, and heartfelt story that helps illuminate child psychology in a way that's entertaining for kids and absorbing for adults. Notice I said story. Even though the animation is great, it's the thoughtful screenplay that propels this creative adventure. Amy Poehler, Bill Hader, Lewis Black, Mindy Kaling, and a talented ensemble provide the voices of a young girl's competing and conflicting emotions. Pixar can probably dust off another spot on their mantle for a Best Animated Feature Oscar, and don't be too surprised if they need to do the same for a Best Screenplay statuette. Inside Out is a classic in the making. Dope is a movie that lives up to its name in a number of ways. While it's very raunchy and some of the ethics are questionable, this R-rated teen tale plays a bit like an urban version of Ferris Bueller, but it's actually better. Shameik Moore is terrific as a bright young lad whose main goal is to get a great education. But his wits are put to the test when he unintentionally gets involved in a big drug deal. It's hip, whip-smart, and skillfully directed by Rick Famuyiwa. Now, while this edgy movie is definitely not for everyone, it's safe to say I'm high on dope. Also opening this weekend, Saint Laurent is a biographical drama about the famed French fashion designer. And the 16th annual Kansas City LGBT Film Festival runs June 25th through July 2nd at the Tivoli Theater. More information is available at tivolikc.com. Well, that's it for this edition of Freeze Frame. Until next time, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI FM. Freeze Frame!
This week on American Roots, it's musical duos Sarah Lee Guthrie and Johnny Irion are folk musicians who share the stage and family life. Also, a visit with New Orleans trumpet player Leroy Jones and his wife Katja Toivola. Plus music from duos Lewis and Ella, George and Tammy, John and Paul. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Wednesday evening from 7 to 9.
Hey, do you want to get rid of your unused car, motorcycle, or boat? and help KKFI at the same time? The proceeds from the sale of your vehicle will benefit KKFI, and the law allows a tax deduction equal to the gross proceeds from the sale of the donated vehicle. For more information, call the toll-free number at 1-866-628-2277.
This is Maria Vasquez Boyd, host and producer of ArtSpeak Radio, inviting you to tune in to ArtSpeak Radio at our new time, Wednesday at noon to 1 p.m. That's right, from noon to 1 p.m. on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome back to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hoag, your host. Yes, arts programming all over the dial here on KKFI. I understand that Bess Wasserstein is going to be on Maria's show on Wednesday. Bess is very, very tall and very talented as well. You'll enjoy listening to her then. I have a very talented and interesting man here with me in the studio right now. His name is Chet Hansen. Chet is an author, a storyteller, a singer, a writer of a new book called The Buyer, all about entrepreneurship. You are an entrepreneur. In fact, don't I remember you writing, except for the time you were in the Army, you've never had a boss.
Thousands of bosses, but I've never worked for anybody.
Well said. Well said. Chet has a new book called The Buyer, and kind of about that. But boy, he has many things as well. Storytelling. He sings. Was a talent agent. In fact, he started an organization that grew to become the seventh largest talent agency in the country. Many famous names on this list here. Steve Martin, George Carlin, Father Guido Sarducci, Randy Newman. Oh, I want to ask you about one of Randy Newman's songs later. Tom Waits, Hoyt Axton, John Prine, Steve Goodman, Kenny Rankin, Joy Jeff Walker. He wrote Bojangles.
He did.
Yeah. And then many others.
Mr. Bojangles, too.
Mr. Bojangles. I remember the Nitty Gritty Dirt version of that, but others recorded that as well.
They did. Well, interestingly, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band had a mistake. They learned it off the Jerry Jeff Walker record. And it's supposed to be a part where Mr. Bojangles says, and he spoke right out. But they misunderstood it. And the line says on their version, and the smoke ran out.
Oh, well, yeah. See, their mind was in some other area, as you well know.
I can't comment on that. I just signed a form saying I wouldn't do such a thing.
Well, I've teased the audience enough. Randy Newman was famous for a song he had at one time called Short People. It was a great song, but some people took offense at that.
Oh, highly. it was just about the time that I left the business. I was with him until right after that song, and then I decided that I really was kind of burnt out on the entertainment world and wanted to get away. But that song, it was the first time I ever received vitriolic hate mail. just because they thought I was a way to get to him, you know.
Oh.
And it was people – there was hardly anyone over 5'5" that wrote that kind of mail. But there were a few short people who really – you know, short people got no reason. No reason to live.
I know.
They got tiny hands and tiny feet and little bitty voices going tweet, tweet, tweet. I mean, yeah, that was a little insult.
Do you have any reason why? Did he just find it funny? Did he mention to you why?
If you spent any time around Randy at all, you know he would spend time thinking about ethereal things that most people don't contemplate. For example, he once had a song called Political Science. Do you remember that one?
Uh-huh, yeah.
And he wrote that during the Jimmy Carter era. But he says, no one likes us. I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one, see what happens. Boom goes Russia. Boom, Paris. More room for you, more room for me. All the world, the whole world round, we'd just be another American town. How happy we will be. We'll set everybody free. There'll be Chinese kimonos for you, baby, and Italian shoes for me. They'll hate us anyhow. Let's drop the big one now. We'll save Australia. We don't want to hurt no kangaroo. We'll build a giant American amusement park there. They have surfing, too. Anyhow, it was a very silly.
He had a great sense of humor. humor.
Great sense of humor. And super, super smart guy and very, actually, extraordinarily humble, too.
I'll bet so. Yeah. You wrote, you want to talk about your book, I know.
I do, because...
You wrote a book called The Fire about entrepreneurship?
Well, it touches on that, but in reality, the protagonist in this book wakes up one morning... And he knows two things, and that seems to be all he has room in his mind for. One, he is wealthy, very, very wealthy, worth over $500 million. And two, there is absolutely no substance to him. There is no me to him. There is nothing that is aware of what is a treasure in the world, what is valuable, what is good. He is only a well-programmed drone that his father created. When he was 11, his mother... Southern romantic, very beautiful woman, but the father was attracted to her for her looks. And he, a self-made multi-millionaire businessman, the money's the only thing that counts, they never bonded. And so they lived two quite separate lives. And he came home one day, and there she is sitting on the sofa with her 11-year-old son on his birthday, reading a book of poetry she bought for that occasion. It was the Rubaiyat, in case anyone's curious. But he said, "Don't you fill his head with that crap. That'll never make him a dime." He grabs the book, throws it across the room, brings in the maid, has her burn it, and sends the mother out of his life for good. She totally disappears, and he doesn't know what's happened to her. His father has taken over the raising of him, and everything, virtually everything, is geared toward expanding the father's empire. Mm. And the boy is real good at it. And he wants his father's approval, as all people do. And what, how this occurred to me is that mothers and fathers especially, mothers and or fathers in today's world especially, have such a heavy imprint on the way the child sees the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you see the world affects the way you live in the world and the kind of life that you have. And a lot of people don't understand this for a long time, for decades. Some people never get it, and they don't know. They just go through life, and they're a failure, but they blame their parents when they figure it out because, well, they made me like this, you know. Well, you have a couple of decisions you have to make. One is, was the imprint that your parents gave you enabling or disabling? If it is disabling, do you just blame them? Or do you try to figure out what you really want out of life? I had an interesting thing. My wife was about 40, and I looked at her, and she looked sad. I said, "What's wrong?" "Nothing." "Come on. What's wrong?" "Nothing." "Come on." "Okay. I was just thinking that ever since we've been together, I've worked for you, and we've done amazing things. We've gone great places. We've met wonderful people. But I really have never in my whole life done what I want to do. First my parents, and then you." And I said, "Well, what do you want to do?" "I'd like to go back and finish school." "I think that'd be a good idea. What do you want to study?" "Well, I was thinking about becoming a personal trainer." And I said, "You know, I know you pretty well. And the two people that you're going to most find are the people who are vain. You don't like those people. Or the people who are so lazy, they have to hire us to get someone's, kick their butt off the couch, you know." I have to be careful what words I use because I signed a little form saying I wouldn't use anything bad.
And, yes, we have that.
Yeah. Okay. And so I said, "Well, what do you want to do? Why do you want to do that?" "I want to do something with health." "Why don't you become a doctor?" "Oh, I'd be 50 before I'm a doctor." "Hun, you're going to be 50 anyhow. When you get there, wouldn't it be nice to be a doctor?" She said, "Whoa, do you think I could?" And she put so much energy into it. She's really a hero to me because she has done amazing things in terms of really trying to fulfill her life's duty. And she's a great doctor. It's embarrassing to go out in public with her, because when we do, people rush up to her. "Oh, you don't know what a wonderful woman this is." I said, "I got a pretty good idea." But so anyhow, the book, The Buyer, is just about how important it is. She told me, I told you that story because she told me when she read this book, it really registered with her how she had to make a decision about what her life had been up to that point in time, what her outside influences had been. And then she made a decision, and she made a change that has enriched her life so much. And this guy, his name is Leonard LaFrance. And I'm telling you, he is as good a businessman as you're going to find. I mean, he's got it down pat. But he's totally innocent about life. He's never had a date. He's never kissed a girl. And so they did have a reward system that his father initiated, that if they did something worthwhile, they could stop a woman on the street, send their assistant out, and offer them multiple thousands of dollars for a night of unquestioned opportunity.
Uh-huh.
And that was his behavior, because that was his father's behavior. And he realized there was nothing to it. Nothing to it. He was a buyer, but there was no satisfaction.
Uh-huh.
There was no personal touch. And as he goes through his life, he starts meeting these wonderful people along the way who are so full of richness. The book starts out thin. I admit that. You're reading it and think, okay, this is an entrepreneur. This is a business guy. This is a, okay, he's really broken up. He's got a psychiatrist. Okay. And then all of a sudden, little by little by little, he starts discovering what's rich about life. And the book itself becomes rich because his life is rich. So the buyer is it's available on Amazon. It's available, but I prefer if you want it to go to a local bookstore. I know that there's a place called Dog-Eared Books in Independence that has it. There's a place called Inklings in Blue Springs that has it. It just came out a few days ago. So, and Inklings, by the way, Inklings. If you like poetry, when I was in there talking with him about the book, a fellow walked up to me, and he was a young guy. It's hard to tell exactly his age because his head was bald, and he had a fairly large dent in his head. And he didn't look real strong. But he came up after we heard me discussing poetry, and I recited a piece of poetry to the owner, and he came up and he said, "Would you like to join our poet's workshop? It's going to be starting in a few minutes." And it was such a nice invitation. I said, "Well, sure, you know, let's do that." Well, it turns out this guy is an amazing poet. He's won some very wonderful things. I don't know how old he is, maybe 22, but he's had a severe case of cancer. And he's just been, life's been ultimately changed. And one of the poems he had was about a woman he had met in Beijing. And there's a line that says, "You held my hand and tried to lengthen my lifeline with your fingernail." What a powerful thought that is.
Yeah.
You know, that's wishing at the highest level. So my life, if I'm writing a book, I've written several to start with, and I've only finished one. But the next book I'm working on is called Somebody Else's Pants. And the reason I came up with that title is because I've looked at my life. And when I was 7 years old, my father took me to the only vaudeville show I ever saw. And the only thing I recall is that the women were scantily dressed. There was two comedians that walked out between each act, whether they're jugglers or whatever, and told a little series of jokes. And the only joke that I can recall, one of the fellows, he was the straight man, said to the funny guy, he said, "Are you any good at arithmetic?" The funny guy said, "Well, I'm pretty good." "Well, let's test you. Let's see how you do. You put your hand in your right pocket. Okay. You got $5,000. All right. Put your hand in your left pocket. Okay. You got $7,000. Okay. What do you got?" "Somebody else's pants." Right? That's the way I feel about my life. Every time I turn around, I find myself in these amazing situations. A little bit probably like, who was the fellow that Forrest Gump character, you know? He kept winding up in these amazing places.
Sure.
And, you know, it's not that I'm so smart. It's not that I'm so talented. I just keep coming to the right place, and I seem to have the right amount of talent to pull off whatever needs to be done right at that point in time.
Yeah, the right place at the right time can mean everything.
It absolutely is. In fact, Steve Martin once said to me, I spent a week at his house, and after about 4 days, we'd only talked maybe 45 minutes total. And he walked up to me and said, "Ask me what is the most important thing about comedy." So, Michael, I will ask you to ask me that question.
Social relevance.
That, and you're not supposed to answer the question. You're supposed to ask the question.
What is the most important thing?
Timing.
About comedy? Yeah.
That's what he told me, and I believe he's quite accurate.
Well, he was quite good at that.
Oh, his timing was wonderful. Yeah.
Where did he pick up the secondary name, A Wild and Crazy Guy?
That was a product of Saturday Night Live, you know, and he and Aykroyd got together and just they were the Wild and the Wild, and it matured. It didn't come out full blown, you know, but they fooled with it and it came out very interesting. But one time, he and his manager Bill McEwen, who is a fellow, by the way, who really had a lot to do with Steve's success, and no one ever speaks of him, but. I was there and I saw it, and he recognized Steve's genius and put himself on the line in every possible situation to move him forward. But I think they probably had a clash of egos, and after six movies together, Steve went on his own way. Steve, at that point, didn't need a manager, very, very smart fellow. But he and Bill McEwen, John Denver, who's also a good friend, and I were all skiing, and it happened to be one of those days in Aspen was 16 degrees below zero. And so Steve and I are sitting in a pair of chairs, and right behind us are Bill and John. And we start up the mountain, and it's so cold, the only thing you could do is just put your arms around your chest and your gloves under your arms and just hold on for dear life, because it's 16 below zero with the wind chill, and I mean, it's miserable. All of a sudden, Steve undoes his arms. He unfolds them, and then he puts one of them on the back of the ski chair. And I hear a little bit of giggling starting in the chair behind us. John and Bill are starting to giggle. Like, what is going on? And then he drops his hand over the back of the armrest like he's being very casual, and then suddenly he grabs me by the far shoulder, pulls me very close, and says, "Moonlight in Vermont." And then howls came from John Denver and Bill McEwen, because he'd done the same thing to John the week before, you know. But he was very spontaneous, very interesting fellow, very sensitive. The other day they had a thing on AFI, the American Film Institute, on his life. And I was a little bit upset with him, to be honest, because when he mentioned me in his autobiography, well, first of all, he misspelled my name. It's O-N, and he put E-N. But oh. that's a natural thing for an artist and agent to go through. But he said that the tour that he was on was booked, and I did the booking, by the Marquis de Sade.
Right? Being you.
It was a torturous tour. Oh. But what happened was, I had known Steve. We both played the Ice House, which is a little place owned by Bob Stain in Pasadena. And it was a launching ground for a number of important people. Not me, but a number of important people. And I saw Steve, and I thought, this guy's brilliant. So I brought him out for a big event I held that had John Denver, Steve Martin, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, the two Brewer and Shipley, who are guys from here, Danny Cox was around here.
Yeah.
The Kingston Trio, the Drifters, had about 30 acts for 38 colleges that all came in to Colorado State University, where we had this event. And we walked out of there. I walked in there with nothing, and within a month I was making ridiculous money. I mean, to this day I say it was ridiculous money. But Steve would sometimes be so funny, like on that particular event, he was so funny that these college kids were laughing really hard. I was sitting on the aisle. Two rows in front of me was a kid sitting on the aisle. He started laughing so hard, he fell out of his chair. But he couldn't quit laughing. And he kept laughing harder and harder, and he wet himself. You know. And so I thought, this is too important a talent not to see what we can really do with him. So I brought him into a place called Marvelous Marv's, which is another really good little club in Denver. And he was so funny sometimes people's face hurt. And then 2 minutes later, he couldn't even get him to smile. Oh. Didn't get any reaction at all. And so when the night was over, I took him out to breakfast. And I said, Steve, you know, you're a genius. There's a couple things, though, that you haven't quite learned. When you're funny and why you're funny. And the only way you're going to learn that is by demonstrating your humor to people and watching their reaction. He says, okay, well, I'll book myself into some clubs in L.A. I know a lot of people. No, you can't do that, because the critics will tear you apart. You need to go to the hinterlands. And this is the Marquis de Sade part. Mm-hmm. I put him in all kinds of little clubs and little coffee houses for colleges all around the country for about 14 months. And he came back and he said, do I have to do this anymore? And I said, no. I said, I think you've got the control of a small room down. Now I'm going to put you on in front of rock bands, like the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, for example, so that you can control 10,000 people. Oh, no. He said, I don't want to do it. Well, he did it. And the thing is, even though he hates me for it, I'm sure, to this day, he became a master at controlling 5, 10, 20,000 people. And he would do things like at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, we did a show there. He took the whole audience, 20,000, 15,000, whatever it holds, up out of their seats, out to a tour of the statuary, the fountains, and gave them this amazing description of what it was. And of course, nothing was real. You know, he just made it up as he went along. So that, and the funny thing is, he was deathly afraid of crowds.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very afraid of crowds. He bought a house in Beverly Hills when he made a big chunk of money. And the house next door had a murder committed. He never set foot in the house. He sold it before he took occupation. So he's a little bit afraid, but I'm glad he has a wife now that he just admires and loves. He says she is as beautiful as she is smart. I thought that was a nice compliment.
Oh, sure. Well, I heard him say on a talk show once, essentially he said, I'm a dud at a party. He says, I'm just not very engaging or conversational or funny at all.
Well, actually, he throws a switch. And I've seen this, like, for example, that ski episode I was talking about. When he was very just getting started, he was also appraising 19th century American artwork. He was very good at that and made some very good money at it. And he had translated the appraisal of two pieces he had just done into a grandfather's clock, a handmade 1700-and-something grandfather's clock from Germany. Filigrees, wood carving, and he had it in this little apartment he had, and this apartment was downstairs from his manager's house in a converted garage. So he had a long, straight, narrow hallway, this clock blocking most of the hallway, and then you get back to this little area to sleep, a little area to eat, and a little bathroom, right? And so we're walking by, then I said, yeah, see, this is beautiful. Oh, yeah. You don't see things like this. Look at the craftsmanship. Look at the filigree. I mean, they don't make things like this anymore. And just about that time, the big hand was on the 12, and the little hand was on the 2. And the clock goes, bong, 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 9 times, right? And Steve says, perfect. So those he would throw in those little switches on and off and be very, very funny. But in his mind, he's always funny, kind of like Arthur. Did you ever see that movie, Arthur?
Oh, yeah.
And he's cracking up the jokes he has going on in his mind. He's so funny. You know? And Steve is kind of that way.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time here. You're also a storyteller. You're demonstrating for us your storytelling skills. And you're a singer. Are you available for storytelling gigs?
You know, I would love to. I actually have some things. What I would do if I were to do a storytelling, I would probably concentrate on lyrics of songs that most people don't really take the time to listen to because they're really quite wonderful. On the book, The Buyer, there's two other places. There's a place called Bella Napoli in Brookside. It's an Italian restaurant, but they also carry the wine we import. And so they're carrying our book, and that's very sweet. And McGonagall's, which is a superb place for meats and fish and that sort of thing, they're carrying the books. And, of course, as I mentioned, Dog-Eared Books and Inklings are – but I hope that I will have more. You can also go into Barnes & Noble and order it, but I would rather you do it business with local people if at all possible.
Oh, I understand that. Yeah. Keep the local ones
supported. Yeah, I mean, I'm a local author, and – We have a wonderful community here. I was really enjoying your previous person here. It was very, very just the creativity that goes on in the city. It rivals anything you're going to find in New York or LA. They might have some refinements, but the basic creativity in this town is really wonderful. I love it a lot.
Yeah.
So how much time do we have left?
Oh, only about 4 minutes. So where do you have a website? Do you want to give that out?
You know, I do. Papachet.com, PAPACHET.com. And I've got some voiceover stuff on there. And I'm just beginning to build it. You have to understand, I'm not exactly a Luddite because I embrace the concept. I just don't know how to use it. So it's in development, but there's some things on there. I just had an agent call me, rather email me today, that said, I just went to your website, and I really like your work. I'd like to use it for some voiceovers, you know.
Oh, so that's great.
That could be fun. Yeah. The reason I asked you, I have a short poem that I wrote for my father.
Okay.
How long do you have enough time?
About 2.5 minutes.
2.5 minutes. That won't take long. Poems for my father. In 1896, the year of his birth, the good old days to some, was it? In some ways. Conversations, not bites. Dinner at the table. Sunset seen from the porch. Trade-offs. No TV, radio, phones, no antibiotics. No chance for his mother, father, or grandmother. orphaned on a hillside in Napa. 14, the sole support of two younger siblings. Chopped wood so dense it dulled the axe, made him a man reluctantly. More boyhood was needed. But then the war, then the Depression. He was skilled with his hands and an agile mind, the passports to a walkabout. He walked.
That's great. We'll have to have you back. There's a lot to cover with Mr. Hansen here, but he'll probably have another book by then. But we want to talk more about the artist he worked with. Is it Athena Artist Corp?
Athena Artist, yeah.
This is a slew of names here. If we went over them, we'd have at least an hour to do that. But the name of his book is The Buyer. It's available at the local bookstores that he mentioned and on Amazon.com. But Chet would prefer you go to one of the local ones.
I would. If you write a review on Amazon.com, though, that's very helpful, especially if it's favorable. But Michael, I'm thankful. You're your first radio show I've ever done to promote anything that I'm doing. I've promoted a lot of other people.
I'll bet.
And
yeah.
I'm very, very grateful to you, and I love your format. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chet. Chet Hansen, author, storyteller, singer, talent agent, and an author, of course. His book, The Buyer, available at the local stores he mentioned, on Amazon.com, and his website probably also, PapaChet, PapaChet.com. So thank you for coming. Come again and tell us more stories about some of these other artists.
It would be a pleasure.
Thank you very much. The Jazz Insider is coming up next. Great jazz. Jazz till, jazz runs from 1 to 3 this afternoon. Then Lady D's going to kick in with the blues from 3 to 6 right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that cross in the road, I'm Michael Hoag. We'll see you next time.